Hello, August.
Hey, Pete.
Welcome to the third episode of Ode to Resilience, our podcast about the Cyber Resilience Act. My name is Pete. I am a CRA consultant. I am a member of the European Expert Group on the CRA, and I am an electrical engineer. How about you, August?
My name's August Bornique. I am a CRA consultant as well. I am also formerly a special rapporteur for the SEAM standard CRA and worked on several of the other vertical standards as well. And I am by training a California licensed attorney.
And today is a special day because we have a third person here for the first time. And our special guest, Goetz, please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Goetz Martinek, and I'm the founder of Sagility. I'm a nerd or computer scientist by nature for more than 40 years now. And with our company, we help customers do software development work. And since 2024, we're working the area of the CRA.
And you're also participating in the horizontal CRA standardization working group, right?
Yes, I'm part of the working group 9. I'm trying to keep up with all the work they're doing, and I have a full-time job with the company, so it is hard, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, and I believe, contrary to August and myself, you are actually still building products and getting your hands dirty. Is that right?
Yes, at least my colleagues do. Yeah.
Yeah, and we can confirm that Goetz is a true nerd because he's sitting in the studio in a Linux shirt.
Yeah, that counts.
That definitely counts. Before we get into the main topic of today, we want to briefly talk about the release of the CRA guidance. So we're recording this episode roughly 1 week before it's aired. When we're recording this, this was hot off the presses. The commission finally released the final version of the interpretive CRA guidance. So what do we all think about that? August, do you want to go first?
Sure, yeah. I haven't read all of it. It's still a big document. And I think there's been pretty substantial changes to it. I think it'll be interesting to see how many of the ones from the group I was working with made it into the final guidance, and also where the changes are. What I've seen so far from the few sections I've looked at has been a mixed bag for me personally. Some things look really good. Some things I have some questions about.
How about you, Goetz?
I'm not sure if it's really final. Thanks for all the work so far, but maybe we get another final one. So
it might be that we get another final one. For myself, I haven't read this version yet because I was on holidays, and for a change, I decided to not read CRA documents during my holidays, which actually turns out to have been an excellent choice. I did see, of course, the draft version, and through the expert group, we reviewed a bunch of intermediate drafts. I think in general, this is a very good document. I think the commission did a really excellent job in thinking through and clarifying a whole bunch of different scenarios and peculiarities. I don't necessarily think that everything that they, or that all the interpretations that they chose are the most sensible ones. But overall, I find it's a very workable document that provides a coherent, almost completely coherent view on the CRA and how to interpret it. So I think that's actually well done. Well done to the commission. Okay. With that, should we move on to the actual order of the day?
Yeah, that sounds good. I was thinking of one thing I wanted to add on the guidance, which is I think when the guidance is paired with the FAQ, with the EC FAQ on the CRA, you get a really full picture of how the CRA works as an entire systemic set of rules or regulations.
And that's,
there's a lot of resources out there that are
also triggers
absolutely
me,
worth looking at.
Triggers me to say that maybe we can very quickly touch on the difference between the FAQ and the guidance. So I'll start by stating it. If anyone disagrees, please call me out on it. But basically, the idea behind the guidance is that it is an interpretation of the CRA that's provided by the commission, whereas the FAQ is just a statement of facts. So when you look at the FAQ, the idea is that nothing that's in there is actually disputable. It's all directly derived from the legal document, whereas when you look at the guidance document, there the commission has taken a lot more freedom to actually interpret some of the matters that are not that clear in the legal text. That, which is also the reason that there are two different documents. And also the commission, when they want to put out a guidance document, they actually need to go through a lot more internal checks than when they just want to put out a statement of facts. And that's why we will likely see these two documents both existing still, because it's much easier for them to update the FAQ than it is for them to update a guidance document.
I'd say when using them, check the FAQ first. It's usually more straightforward. It's usually easier to grasp, to approach. The guidance can get pretty tricky at times and pretty complex because it's dealing with the edge cases and the sort of deeper concerns that the CRA has brought up and that various people trying to look at the CRA have raised. So start with the first one, move on to the second one, and then you're on your own after that, I guess.
And also the guidance is written in a way that it is completely inconclusive of anything. It always says that if this is the case, then it may be the case that you should interpret it this way. And
it's always worth reading the references in the guidance, though. Yeah. The references are also very important to both those documents. But anyways, we actually had something to talk about besides what other people are saying about the CRA, right?
Yes, exactly. The reason why Götz is here today is because he asked us a question about a week ago, and we were thinking what we're going to record as a third episode. And we thought that question, that would be an excellent third episode. So, Götz, do you want to go ahead and phrase that question?
I try to remember. I think the question was, what's the minimal product with digital elements you can think of? The background was we have customers not only with one or two or 10 or 50 products, sometimes they have hundreds of products, and they need to at least roughly check if these products are affected by the CRA or not. And sometimes some are obviously not affected by the CRA, and some are on the edge. And that's why I was thinking of this question and asking the guys I know who know a lot more about the CRA than I do. So that was the question.
Well, but the reason we invited you is because we think you actually know a lot more about it than you let on as well. So
thank you.
Do you want to, how should we do this? Should we start by giving our opinion, or do you want to give your interpretation first?
I can start if you'd like.
Can I just ask you a question, Götz?
Yes,
of course. The thing that's interesting to me about your question is, what do you mean by minimal product? What is that? What are the specifics that, like, help me visualize this, either with an example maybe or just a description?
The guidance says something about digital communication, like just on off is not okay. And one thing we came across was like a product just sending data, which by technical design cannot receive data. The guidance doesn't say anything about, okay, only sending data, you're out. So this one question is, how technically can you be to get out of the CRA or to perhaps get a more easier way in the compliance? Because all the paperwork for just so small and many products, it feels like, sorry to say, wasting money. This money can better be placed on product where it's useful if you really improve their cybersecurity.
Yeah. So if I maybe could try to rephrase your question and thesis, and then you can say whether I got it correctly or not. You are asking, what is the minimum set of technical functionality that a product must have in order for it to fall under the CRA? And when it falls under the CRA, even if it's a very trivial product, do you then still need to do all of the compliance paperwork, even when it's obviously clear that there is not a significant amount of cybersecurity risk in your product?
Yes, that's a good rephrasal.
Okay. I feel like we should start by looking at what exactly the scope of the CRA is to answer this one.
That's where I was going to go. I was going to say, I think the CRA makes this easy, which is a lie. This is not a simple question, but we do see Article 2 of the CRA, Section 1, starts by saying what the CRA covers, and that is, this regulation applies to products with digital elements made available on the market the intended purpose or reasonably foreseeable use of which includes a direct or indirect logical or physical data connection to a device or network. Real simple, right? That's just that it's not as if almost every single word in that definition has its own specific legal meaning. And this is something that I wanted to raise before we really get to the details here. Almost every couple words in section one of Article 2 is what I would call a term of art, which is to say it is a definition. It is defined within the CRA, possibly elsewhere, but in this case, we're going to look at within the CRA to have a specific legal meaning. For example, hardware here means something very particular. Product with digital elements means something very particular. And that has to be respected and it has to be acknowledged, and it can make things harder or maybe it makes things clearer. So that's the first thing that we have to do, is then go look at the definitions and see what we're really dealing with here.
Yeah. So the most important definition in that sentence, I would say, is this product with digital elements. Because you often hear this statement that says that the CRA applies to all products with digital elements. If you really read that sentence, the sentence that we read out before, more carefully, you'll see that's not quite true, because it only applies to product with digital elements made available on the market, and the intended or reasonably foreseeable use of them needs to include this direct or indirect logical or physical data connection to a device or network. So I tend to say that the CRA only applies to products that have some sort of data interface to another product or network or thing. Notably, that's excluding things that just communicate with a human. That doesn't count. But still, the definition really, or this scope statement is centered around this term product with digital elements. So what is a product with digital elements?
I like to call it a PWIDI. I won't even say that ever again. A product digital elements is, the drafters of the CRA think it's the most important definition because it's the first definition. A product with digital elements means software or hardware product and its remote data processing solutions, including software or hardware components being placed on the market separately. Again, we've got a lot of definitions and lots of terms of art in that definition, but what we do have is effectively three classes of thing that are placed on the market. And that's hardware, software, and remote data processing solutions, which is RDPS.
Yeah.
And we're not going to talk about that today because that's its own rabbit hole for a different time.
Plus, I would argue that for Goetz's question, RDPS is actually an irrelevant concept because we're looking at the minimal product, and the minimal product is not going to have some cloud service. So I think we can ignore that. And then basically it means that product with digital elements means a software or hardware product, which really does not say anything.
Those are definitions, Article 3, 4 for software and 5 for hardware. Not that these are amazing definitions.
Will you enlighten us?
I don't think I can.
Will you read them for
But
us?
I'll let the CRA enlighten us as much as it can. I feel like I'm like performing some kind of priestly function here. I'm reading from the great work here. So Article 3, Definitions, Section 4, software means the part of an electronic information system which consists of computer code. Note that electronic information system is also a definition. Hardware, this is Section 5, means a physical electronic information system or parts thereof capable of, and this is where it gets a little interesting, processing, storing, or transmitting digital data. So does that help? Is that clear now, what we're dealing with?
I think there is nothing left for discussion after this.
All right. It's been fun. Thank you for joining us. Question answered.
I'm wondering if we should still let the audience suffer through the definitions of electronic information system, logical connection and physical connection, and then indirect connection, because they're all defined. But
we could each read one of them at once as fast as possible.
Oh, I think we should do that. Goetz is protesting very heavily, but maybe.
Goetz, do you want to take 7 electronic information system? I'll take... logical connection? And Pete, you take this.
No. I think we have four definitions and only three people, so I think we cannot do this exercise.
You do this very well.
It's probably for the best. It's read it on your own.
It's probably
for the best. Read it on your own.
Read it on your own.
Follow along at home.
Yeah. But maybe let's move away a bit from the legalese and start talking about what this stuff actually means. So in my interpretation, a product with digital elements is any product that contains some form of non-trivial logic. That is actually not a universally accepted statement. Some people would say that if you have a product with trivial logic, that would also be a product with digital elements. For example, I have to admit that I'm not as good as an electrical engineer anymore as I used to be, but you have these, what is it? Is it 70,800 series? Or you can buy these distinct logic gates in a chip. And some people would probably argue that if you buy an AND gate packaged as a chip, that would be a product with digital element. Personally, I'm feeling that, you know, maybe it's not. But as soon as your product has some more advanced logic functionality, it definitely is a product with digital elements. Then that doesn't mean yet that it's in scope of the CRA, because it still needs to be placed on the market. I think the discussion of what that means exactly we will not have here today, because that's a completely different discussion. But it needs to have that the intended purpose or reasonably foreseeable use of that product needs to include a direct or indirect logical or physical data connection to a device or network. So it needs to have some sort of data interface to something else.
I think one thing we can do is define this sort of in the inverse. Do we know anything that the EC or the CRA itself says maybe a product of digital elements in the broader sense, but it is not covered by the CRA? And we do
have some
examples.
I have one on my desk
from the guidance. What is it, Pete?
I have on my desk, this will sound like an advertisement, but I have on my desk a Casio FX991 ES Plus calculator from back in high school, which is a calculator. It's a scientific calculator, but it's a rather dumb scientific calculator. So it doesn't have any sort of infrared interface or serial port or anything like that. It's just a calculator with buttons and a screen, and those are the only ways to interact with it. So this is clearly a product with digital elements, but it does not have any form of logical or physical data connection to another device or network, direct or indirect. It just has an HMI that I as a human interact with. Good seems to disagree.
Kind of. Have you ever opened it and checked if there's a JTAG or some similar flashing pin there? So it could probably get a new software on it.
Yeah. So I have never checked that. It is closed. There are four Phillips head screws on the back. But I think the point that you're raising is quite an interesting one. And that is, so this product, it does not have any interface on the outside. It also is not a product that's intended to be serviced, so there is no service port. But when you open the product, there might still be a technical possibility to interact with the product on the inside of the enclosure, which might be relevant if there would be a problem with these calculators and they somehow get sent back to the Casio product development lab where they are opened and updated or some diagnostics is being done on them.
We also envision a foreseeable use that is not an intended use.
Yeah, correct.
In which there's, say, a culture of vintage calculator hackers. Mm. And Casio is like, hey, we can sell a lot of these old calculators we have in storage, or we can start making them anew specifically for this niche, incredibly niche hobby of going in, pulling them out apart, and fiddling with whatever kind of interface there is in there.
Yeah.
Which it seems unlikely, but I don't know. I don't know what people get up to these days. I'm an old man.
So my feeling is that if a client would come to me and they would ask, well, if Casio would obtain my services, and I'm pretty sure they still sell a very similar module, and they ask, do we need to do a CRA declaration for this product? I would probably say no. Because yes, there almost certainly is a JTAG interface or something somewhere in this product, but it seems quite reasonable to me to argue that is not a part of the intended purpose or reasonably foreseeable use of this product. It's a purely technical measure that is not intended to be used by anyone outside of the Casio factory.
And you could argue they've taken mitigations to prevent that use. There's four Phillips head screws back there, protecting whatever's inside from, you know, that foreseeable misuse.
Additionally, I would argue that if this calculator would be compromised, then it is extremely unlikely that there would be any meaningful risk involved, which would almost certainly render a non-compliance of this calculator a so-called formal non-compliance. So it's just where your paperwork is not in order, rather than an actual non-compliance based on a defect. So it wouldn't be a dangerous product. And those two cases are still treated differently as well.
And that's why I'm not joking when I say that I think the mitigations, if they are necessary on that product, of making you have to screw off four screws are probably sufficient because it's not a use case with a lot of risk or impact.
This calculator is actually quite different from another product that we were also discussing a bit before, which is a washing machine, for example. I know that my parents' washing machine that does not have any Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or other fancy functionality does have a infrared port, which is used by technicians to read out diagnostic information from the washing machine. And August looks like he wants to interrupt me, so go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to say, both with the calculator and the washing machine, one of the reasons we're focusing on these two things is because these are two products that are listed within the guidance as being products with digital elements that are not covered by the CRA. And specifically when they talk about the washing machine, when the ECS decided to talk about the washing machine, they make a big point that it has embedded firmware, that it does have this software in it. It's doing product digital element things, but it's embedded. It can't be changed. It's there for good. And okay, so that is, I think, the distinction.
So this is interesting because I don't have the specific guidance example in my head right now, but I would actually argue that this washing machine that has the diagnostic interface for service technicians is actually in scope of the CRA, because the service technicians that will diagnose this product, they will do that in the field. They will be entities which are independent of the manufacturer. And they are one of the intended users of this product. And it's a class of user of the product as a technician. And them being able to troubleshoot the product through this interface is actually part of the intended purpose and reasonably foreseeable use of the product. So I would argue that if a client would come to me and they're making such a product, I would tell them, yes, you should do a declaration of conformity for the CRA, because you have that data interface that is intended to be used in the field as part of the intended purpose or reasonably foreseeable use. We should probably go and check to see whether or not that example in the guidance mentions anything about the service interface.
I'll look that up. I don't think it does. I read it this morning. I could be wrong, but I'm almost positive it doesn't.
Because there are definitely also washing machines that don't have that interface.
What is interesting to me when you're describing this is that this is a function of the product. It is actually an intended function of the product, as you say, but it is not one that immediately jumps to mind as being, oh, this is a networked washing machine. It's not some Internet of Things washing machine that you tell to make extra suds while you're out of the house. And there's enough of those. But I think for manufacturers of even relatively simple products, you can run afoul of the CRA pretty quickly. And that's one of the things that I really took from Guts's question is, look, you have this washing machine that only the maintenance tech is going to poke around in. How much compliance work does the washing machine manufacturer really need to do for that? And is it worth it for them to completely make it so that no one ever fixes the washing machine, that it's just disposable at a certain point or non-upgradable? Or is it worth it for them to still do that compliance because it's such minimal compliance? And I don't really have thoughts on that, but I'm hoping you two do.
I don't, but I think it's even worse than that, because if you think of a service port or something, it's more like, okay, this is intended to change something on the machine, on the firmware, on the software. So you can influence it and you can, in the worst case, make it do bad things like screwing up your laundry. But on the other hand, is like only read-only diagnostic ports. And even for read-only, you can distinguish between technically only reading and technically communicating bidirectional, but only sending data to you. not accepting any update commands or something. And I don't know how deep you have or you, how deep you need to go to the technical details to say I'm in or I'm out.
Yeah. So the CRA does not actually specify any of that, right? Like when it's about the unidirectionality of the link, etc., whether you can actually make any changes. There is nothing in the scope statement that says that one of those cases would be in scope and another one of those cases would be out of scope. So my view, and I'm looking at the lawyer in the room here, is that means that they're all in scope.
I think they're all in scope. And I think this is something that came up in discussion of RDPS as well, repeatedly, about whether it's unidirectional or multidirectional. And my take is that, well, obviously, if the washing machine is sending out data about how many loads of laundry it's been doing or when it needs a new bearing or something like that, it's really no one, people don't care too much, presumably. But there are certainly products out there that might be only unidirectional that could be sending pretty sensitive data, whether that's a crib monitor or, you know, anything like that. I think of another product that I had a long discussion with another rapporteur about, which was a novelty camera. And this, we at first thought, oh, this is, wow, this is a real product with digital elements that does not fall into CRA. It turns out it had a port in it and you could pull the pictures off of it, even though it mostly just printed them on receipt paper. It was quite a charming little horrible toy. But you're talking about photos of people. So you already have maybe a higher level of care that needs to be, higher duty of care that needs to be applied to that product because of the kind of data that it's intended to collect.
So if I could try to summarize the discussion up till now, I think we've concluded that basically all of the products or almost all of the products that you could think of are going to be in scope of CRA. There is a very limited set of products that don't have any data interface at all, that are not in scope, for example, this calculator. But a product really does not need to have a lot of advanced functionality for it to become in scope of the CRA. That brings us to the second question, though, or the second part of the question, which is, okay, we've established that we have a product that's in scope of the CRA. Now, do we really need to do the entire compliance shebang for it? And wouldn't it make more sense to, or is that really sensible? Wouldn't it make more sense to use our resources on products that actually pose a cybersecurity risk? I have an opinion on that, but maybe want to check if anyone else here in the room has an opinion on that they want to share first.
No, I. It sounds like it's you.
Okay, I'll go for it. So I'll start with the risk assessment, because the risk assessment is the most important part of a CRA compliance, a piece of CRA compliance documentation. And my answer to the question is that basically, yes, for any product that is in scope, you will need to do a formal risk assessment and you will need to document that. However, I also believe that for these very simple products, the risk assessment can also be very basic. And what I would imagine that a risk assessment for such a basic product would look like is just a little Excel list, or maybe it's even a Word document, where you go over all of the essential requirements in the CRA, the part one essential requirements, so the one about technical properties for the product. You go over those and you write one or two sentences arguing why this essential requirement is either not applicable to the product, or what's probably more likely going to be the case, why there is no meaningful amount of risk involved for the product for that specific essential requirement. Instead of going over the essential requirements, you could also iterate over the threats that will be defined in EN40000-1-4, which will be the horizontal CRA product standard that will describe technical features for things that you could do to make your product more secure, which will also include a catalog of threats, like more specific technical threats that are still very high level, but that are a bit more specific than each of the essential requirements, but that can still be linked back to those essential requirements. And when you're dealing with a very, very basic product, for example, this laundry machine that just has that infrared diagnostic port, you don't need to spend a lot of time thinking about these threats to argue why they are not that relevant for your product or why there is not a lot of risk. If you have that laundry machine and you have that diagnostic interface and there is a threat that someone could, through that diagnostic interface, tamper with the data that's on the washing machine and could somehow change the laundry cycle and would make it catch fire, then even though that sounds scary, it's probably not that big of a risk for your product because the likelihood that would happen is quite low because somebody needs to really go and physically attack that product, that specific product. Plus, it's not quite clear what their motivation would be to do so. Plus, if they have physical access to the product and they want to start a fire, they could also just light a match.
Would that change, Pete, if it was a high security laundry machine, like to be used in, say, institutions for dangerous folks?
Maybe. I think it would change if it was a laundry machine that was, for example, specifically intended to wash the outfits of nuclear radiation workers. Because that laundry machine, like that specific risk might become relevant because that laundry machine could be subject to a supply chain attack where a different firmware is loaded onto it. And then that machine would be in a highly critical environment. So you could use that machine maybe as a way to smuggle something that will start a fire into such an environment.
Irradiated jumpsuits just everywhere. It doesn't clean them properly.
To be
anymore.
Honest,
I don't know.
To be honest, I think that risk would still be pretty low and probably would still be acceptable, but it would be higher than for the generic laundry machine. So yes, like depending on what exactly the intended purpose and reasonably foreseeable use of the machine is, these risk scenarios will change. What is important to remember though is that the existence of the diagnostic port would be the thing that brings this laundry machine in scope of the CRA. However, once it is in scope, the entirety of the machine is subject to the CRA. So all of the risks that apply to the product, and not only the risks that apply to this diagnostic port. So there might be other threats that are unrelated to the diagnostic port that you still need to consider. For this laundry machine, probably not relevant, but there might be other products for which it's relevant.
The thing you touched on there that I want to go back to for a second, and I think is important for manufacturers, is the CRA really cares a lot about who you sell the product to, who you intend the product to be used by, where you intend the product to be used, the intended use. And you could have the same product. And depending on whether you said this was to be used in an industrial setting or a small business or at home, it would dramatically change the security requirements of that product. And it would change the risk assessment. So I think that's a starting point for people doing these assessments and doing this compliance, is you don't just look at the product in the abstract, what might happen somewhere, somehow. You really do go to those threats based on the intended purpose and the foreseeable use.
What to do if you're a manufacturer and you actually do not know how people use your product with digital elements? There's plenty of them, I think.
Especially if they're components.
Yeah, so let's say that you're selling microcontrollers. If you're selling microcontrollers, you don't really know in detail how they're being used. Even worse, let's say that you're selling MEMS compasses, so compass chips, right? These, or an accelerometer or whatever, something like that. As a manufacturer, you don't know how your product is going to be used because it depends a lot on who is going to integrate your product. But what you do know is that whenever your product is going to be used, it's going to be subject to an integration activity where engineers will look at your product, look at the documentation. And that means that there are some reasonable assumptions that you can make about the people that are going to be integrating your product into another product. And that also means that if you can supply the right amount of documentation that reasonably allows those people to do that integration in a secure way, that's probably enough. So in those cases, I see a strong argument that can be made there that the product is only intended to be integrated in another product. So that changes the requirements quite dramatically. And there is also some responsibility that can be placed on the integrator. Of course, not all of it, and you need to make sure that the integrator actually has the information available that they need in order to integrate the product securely. That's actually also one of the requirements from Annex 2. But that's basically the only way that these requirements can be interpreted in a way that is reasonable for the manufacturer of the component. And also from a technical perspective, it just makes sense. I wanted to jump back a bit to this question about what compliance documentation do you actually need? And let's assume that we're not talking about the component-only product. In my view, you need this risk assessment, which can actually be quite high level. And for trivial products, you shouldn't be afraid to just make quite large statements in which you say, we've thought about all of the data stored on this product and whether it can be manipulated in some way and whether or not there's risk involved with that. And just say, we've looked at this and we don't see any meaningful risk. Because the fact that you went through the essential requirements or to the EN40000-1-4 risks, that still shows that you have done this exercise of at least at the high level thinking about whether there's any risk involved in your product. And then your risk assessment is just the documentation that you've done that.
Can we imagine what you would have to do if we took a particular essential cybersecurity requirement and we took the washing machine with the maintenance port? One I like here, it's just a personal favorite, is cybersecurity requirement Annex 1, Part 1, Section 2, Subsection G. This is data minimization. The product with digital elements must process only data, personal or other, that are adequate, relevant, and limited to what is necessary in relation to the intended purpose of the product with digital elements. And then in parentheses, data minimization. So how do you show that you're doing your data minimization for your washing machine?
So what I would do is I would say that we have designed the laundry machine in such a way so that all of the sensor data it collects and processes is actually necessary for its core function that is doing the laundry. And we're not doing something like putting a microphone on the laundry machine and for some reason collecting everything, all the audio of what is being said in front of the washing machine. Which you would think is an absurd example, but I believe there are actually examples of smart TVs that were doing exactly this.
And the way you would test that, be able to test that, you could say anybody who takes this washing machine and attaches a diagnostic tool to the diagnostic port, all they can download or all they can extract from that, however you want to phrase it, is, you know, runtime of the washing machine, what cycles were used, blah, blah, blah. So maybe they could tell wear and tear or whatever.
But also, when we get to testing, that's a perfect segue into the other part of the risk assessment that I wanted to talk about. Because when you look at Article 13, and now I'm scrolling very quickly through my CRA copy to be able to give you the right quote. But Article 13 says that the cybersecurity risk assessment shall also indicate how the manufacturer is to apply Part 1.1 of Annex 1 and the vulnerability handling requirement set out in Part 2 of Annex 1. And it's particularly that last part that is interesting here because Part 2, the vulnerability handling requirements, are actually a lot broader than just talking about CVE monitoring, etc. But also, for example, Part 2.3 talks about apply effective and regular tests and reviews of the security of the product with digital elements. What you were suggesting, August, is testing about whether you're only collecting the minimal amount of data. Part of that is going to be part of your compliance assessment, but arguably a part of that could also be part of applying effective and regular tests and reviews of the security of the product with digital elements. And the fact that in your security risk assessment, you have to describe how you're going to do that vulnerability handling, that is also indicating to me that depending on the risk profile of your product, you might also want to do more or less vulnerability handling, which includes product testing. So I would argue that in case for a laundry machine, that it doesn't make a lot of sense to have a big formal check where you're checking that really you're not processing any other data because it is a fairly low risk product. Also, this particular essential requirement is quite difficult because you need to prove the absence of something rather than that you are doing something. So that's always a bit tricky. But I would just argue here, use common sense and don't feel like you have to do some big administrative test just because there is this essential requirement that you had in your risk assessment. But instead, think about like what are the things that we need to do to actually make this product more secure? And that might basically be nothing if it's a very trivial product.
And from my point of view, some people tend to do the retesting or continuous testing. They tend to do a continuous reassessment of the whole product. And for me, it's like you can separate those. You can do reassessment with everything, but continuously just concentrate on the software part, on the parts which are actually unit tests, integration tests, whatever you can do, or check your APIs and stuff to be robust without accepting everything.
Yeah. And there we also get into another very interesting topic that we really shouldn't be going in today, but that's the idea of continuous compliance, where also the entire compliance assessment for your product, you would automate that and make that part of your CI/CD pipeline rather than to do what now is often a manual process where you're actually checking whether all of the compliance requirements for the product are met. I think, however, that we can round off this question about the minimal product, at least the minimal hardware product. We've established that almost every product is going to be in the CRA scope. And yes, you do need to do the paperwork, but the complexity of the paperwork can also scale with the type of product, and you don't have to create a 200-line risk assessment for a product for which it's quite obvious that there is no risk. You just need to be able to document that you actually considered whether there is risk and that you concluded that there was none. And that can be a quite granular exercise. And also, if you're a manufacturer that has a lot of products, it's very likely that the argumentation for all of your products is going to be very similar. So that also means that this risk assessment for your very simple products could also be a very modular document, where if you have a whole bunch of products that have similar features, then your argumentation for why those products, why there is risk or there is not risk for those products, can also be shared. So you don't have to redo this for every product, and you might be able to risk assess the whole part of your portfolio in one go.
Would it be also fair to say that when you're preparing this technical documentation, this is not for public consumption?
Correct.
This is something that is going to sit with your company and only come out if there's a severe incident or a known exploitable vulnerability, known exploited vulnerability that attracts the attention of the regulators. So that is not to say don't do it, you know, YOLO, wait to see what happens. I would never say that. But again, this is not something that you are putting in a pamphlet with every washer sold. It doesn't have to be pretty.
And there are still, however, things that you need to do for all your products. Because, for example, you will still have the requirement that you need to store your technical documentation for at least 10 years, and you will still have the requirement that you need to supply the information and instruction to the user, as is in Annex 2. You will have to define a support period. You also have to provide a single point of contact where customers could contact your organization if there are any security-relevant concerns or questions with the product.
Doesn't that have to be digital as well, or at least I think
there's a requirement somewhere that says that that communication endpoint cannot rely only on automated means. So not just an AI chatbot. And there's a bunch of these things that you will still have to do. So there is still some administration that you will have to go through. But if you're a company that sells a larger portfolio of products, you can probably rely on a lot of the things that you're already doing for those other products in order to facilitate the compliance for those simpler products. For example, if you already have a product where you have a contact address and you have a pcert which is meant to receive security notifications for your product, well, then there is no additional work when you have a very basic product that the pcert also needs to handle, because the pcert is already there. They just need to know that the product exists, but the probability that a notification for that product would come in is near zero.
Should we ask if Gotz feels like his question's been answered, or have we just passed the buck? Have we just said, yeah, it'll be fine, don't worry about it?
Or did we confirm your nightmares?
You confirm my nightmares. It's a good phrase, yeah. It's okay. It's at least we are on the same page, yeah, and we say, okay, it's like that, so we have to live with it.
And everybody's got to do it, right? It's a cost that will be borne by everybody except open source. We've been talking about what digital elements are. We have not really addressed what's not a product, which it's its own discussion. But I think for most people listening to this, it's probably, they probably got a product.
And another thing that we didn't touch today, even though we had it on the outline to talk about, is software products, where we can basically summarize it as saying that if you're selling software, that software is almost certainly in scope of the CRA.
You don't have to just be selling it. If you're giving it away for commercial purposes, such as the example in the CRA that's a bit famous now, is to collect people's user data and use it to target ads, you've got to comply with the CRA. I don't know about advertising, though. That's the one that I always bring up, and I've not gotten a clear answer on. Yeah. If you're giving away an app or piece of software as a freebie to encourage people to use your services or otherwise to make money off of it, do you need to be CRA compliant?
So should we summarize by saying that if you're selling a product and it has digital elements and it's hardware and it has a data interface or it's software, the answer to the question you're to ask is yes, it is in fact in scope. And yes, in fact, you do need to do all of the paperwork, but the paperwork doesn't need to be a ton of work and you can be pragmatic about it.
Let's not say selling. Can we say if you're commercializing, if you're intending to make some money off it somehow?
When you are making it available on the market as part of a commercial activity.
Yeah, that would be the technical. Yes, that is correct.
That's how we make the lawyer happy.
Yes, that is that. I'm happy now. I can go nap.
With that, let's do that and let's call it a day. So thank you, August and Götz.
Yeah, Götz, thank you for joining us for the question.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And to the audience, we hope to hear you again in probably 2 weeks.
And look at your washing machine closely. It might be... No, never mind. Don't worry about your washing machine.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye.